As humans, we love to complicate things, right? We're like, well, which one? And is it resistance training? And is it hot? Is it HIIT? Is it spin class? Is it CrossFit? Is it, you know, it's like, just go for, if you don't know, just go for a walk. You're standing up, so you're not seated at your desk. Legs are working, heart is working. You know, you're increasing your capacity for glucose disposal because the legs are, you know, kind of gobbling up all the glucose that's being, you know, out in the bloodstream for that utilization. It's good for the, you know, cardiometabolic, like just go for a 20-minute walk. You know, sometimes we have to get back to the foundational basics of nutrition and movement first, and then supplementing, as the name suggests, to supplement that with what you're...
Welcome to Better with Dr. Stephanie. I am your host, Dr. Stephanie Estima. This show is for women just like you with a deep desire for learning, self-actualization, and becoming more of who you already are. Every week, we are going to deconstruct how to build better bodies, better minds, better relationships, better sex, and better families. I'll be giving you access to world-class thought leaders to help give you the tools to answer this question. What are the simplest things that you can do today to get better tomorrow? I am part geek, part magic, and want to share the juiciest questions, topics, and often taboo conversations that I think I've always wanted to be a part of and I wanted to be having. So let's get better together. Hey, Betties. Welcome back to Better with Dr. Stephanie. It's me, your host, Dr. Stephanie Estima. Today's conversation is with Dr. Dadis Karazian. He is a Harvard Medical School trained and award-winning clinical research scientist, academic professor, and world-renowned functional medicine healthcare provider. Dr. Karazian has developed evidence-based models to treat autoimmune, neurological, and unidentified chronic diseases with non-pharmaceutical applications. And his clinical models of evidence-based medicine are used in several academic institutions, thousands of healthcare providers at this point throughout the world. Dr. Karazian is an associate clinical professor at the Loma Linda University School of Medicine. Now, our conversation is very wide, as it is deep. We start off talking about brain health, of course. This is his specialty. And we start talking about Alzheimer's. We talk about brain fog. We talk about what happens when the blood-brain barrier is compromised. We talk about some of the effects of having that compromise through excess or poor blood sugar control, stress, and the neurophysiology of stress. We talk about circadian biology and things like why waking up overnight is not normal, even if it's to pee. And we get into hormones as well. So we talk a lot about hormones in men and in women. So we start off our conversation with low T or low testosterone in men and why supplementing with exogenous testosterone might not be the solution. And I think that the answer will really surprise you. And he talked about how really, especially with our beautiful men, you know, this perfect storm of low testosterone and low dopamine, why men who are experiencing both of these things simultaneously, why it's so hard for them to initiate change, and why we, as their partners, as their friends, as their lovers, as their mothers, sisters, it is really, really helpful for us to get them the help that they are seeking because they can't just seem to do it on their own. We talk about hormones in women, of course. We talk about high testosterone in women. Of course, we talk about polycystic ovary syndrome. We talk about perimenopause and menopause and the thyroid. And then we also talk about some clinical, we share some clinical observations with him, with each other. So I talked to him about my observation with oxygen and oxygenation levels. We talk about glucose. We talk about novelty and stimulation. Overall, it's a super nerdy conversation. I really enjoyed it and I hope that you will as well. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Dr. Dadis Karazian. One of my goals this year is to make it my best year ever with my skin. And one of the ways that I'm doing that is with the Bond Charge Red Light Neck and Chest Mask. Wrinkles, acne, scarring, skin roughness, loss of collagen and elastin happen in the face and in the neck and the décolletage area on our chest where the skin is very thin and susceptible to skin damage. I think at this point we're all pretty good about putting sunscreen on our face, but so many of us miss the neck and the chest area too. I use the Bond Charge neck and chest mask daily for about 10 minutes in the morning while I'm checking emails. Their red and near infrared light waves together penetrate up to 5 to 10 centimeters below the skin surface. The red light reaches the skin's top layers, and the NIR light targets the deeper tissues without UV exposure, and that's going to help reduce the fine lines, wrinkles, and to help ramp up collagen and elastin production. So I want you to head over and have your best skin with me this year. Go to bondcharge.com/better. That's BETTER. And use the discount code BETTER at checkout. And that's going to give you 15% off your entire cart. Transform your health and fitness with the Carol Bike, the smartest, most effective exercise backed by science. You can experience unparalleled results in just a minimum of 15 minutes per week, thanks to AI personalized workouts tailored to your age and your fitness level. You will increase fat loss, train up your strength and your speed, and have better energy, something that every woman, including myself, absolutely covets. I always say that women are the original biohackers. If there's a way for us to feel better and look better, we are all over it. Carol Bike, in my opinion, is one of the best pieces of cardio equipment that you can invest in. Studies prove that Carol helps you achieve a 12% increase in cardio fitness, lowers the risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and reduces blood pressure by 5% in as little as 8 weeks. Begin your transformation with the Carol Bike today and enjoy $100 off using the promo code BETTER for our beautiful Better Podcast listeners. That's BETTER. All you have to do is visit carolbike.com.
Today, I am so excited to welcome you, Dr. Datis Karazian, to the podcast. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
I originally reached out to you and your team because I wanted to get you on here as one of the foremost experts in terms of brain health. And specifically, I wanted to talk about a lot of inflammation. So one of the things that I, in my practice and with the clients that I work with, I tend to work with women, as I was saying in the pre-chat, lots of women listen to this podcast, and in my private clients tend to be females as well. And I wanted to start our conversation today around probably the most common complaint I get, which is brain fog. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the term brain fog is essentially meaningless. I mean, it's sort of a descriptor. It's kind of like pain. You know, it's like, well, what does pain mean? Is it throbbing? Is it achy? Is it electric? Is it bilateral? You know, so what we know about brain fog is that there's some undercurrent of inflammation happening, but it can have many different etiologies in terms of why someone might be experiencing it. So I wanted to maybe start off our conversation and begin to unpack, and maybe you can start by defining what inflammation is and how it manifests in the brain.
Sure. So inflammation is basically a heightened state of the immune system. It's reacting to various factors, whether it's an environmental pathogen or infection, or it could even be food proteins that trigger the immune response. It could be environmental chemicals that trigger the immune response. But what happens is when the immune system gets triggered, it creates these messenger proteins that then cause destruction against the compound, like the dietary protein, maybe a food sensitivity or an environmental compound, or maybe a virus or bacteria. But then those inflammatory mediators also cause some type of havoc against our own tissue. So when we get inflamed, our joints hurt, or tissues hurt, or muscles, get sore. And the same thing happens in the brain. This inflammatory response turns on special cells in the brain called microglia, and they get activated from this inflammatory response, whether it's from a food protein or environmental triggers or from an infection. And then the brain has these microglial cells release a bunch of mediators that actually promote brain degeneration over time. It's chronic inflammation. These inflammatory mediators shut down ideal neurotransmitter function in the brain. It's associated with what they call inflammatory-based depression or the cytokine model of depression. And it really has a significant impact on also brain endurance. These inflammatory mediators uncouple or dysregulate mitochondria in the brain, or these energy-producing cells in the powerhouses in the cells in the brain, and then people get brain fatigue. So when someone is inflamed and has systemic inflammation, and their joints don't feel joint swelling and pain, but in the brain, they're going to have a brain that gets tired very quickly. They're going to be prone to depression, and in addition, not going to have an efficient brain function, which, as you know, many people refer to as brain fog, or coming in with the symptoms of brain fog, depression, and having no brain endurance are all signs that the brain's inflamed.
Yeah. And like, I also hear things like, you know, it just feels like I have the word in my head, but I can't get it. You know, like the cogs, they're not turning the way that they should. And one of the things I think most people don't recognize is that the microglia, which is sort of the immune system of the brain, if you will, they outnumber our brain cells, right? So we often think of neurons as being the primary cell in the brain, but microglia outnumber them by about 10 to 1. And I always, when I'm explaining astrocytes or whatever it is, I will, the way that I describe it is that they're almost like the landscape artists of the brain, right? Like they're the ones that are mowing and keeping the grass looking clean. They're getting rid of weeds and they're getting rid of, you know, dendrites or, you know, cellular debris that may not necessarily be useful or functional anymore. But there are also ways that we can overactivate the microglia as well. So maybe you can, and you've touched on a few of them, but maybe we can talk about what are some ways that the microglia get activated and potentially overactivated.
Sure. And this is an important question because at the end of the day, how we preserve our brain is really going to determine the quality of life we have, especially as we get older.
Yeah.
So if we have constant brain fog for decade after decade after decade, you know, as we get older, we're going to have early dementia, we're going to have neurodegenerative diseases, we're going to lose volume of our brain, our ability to focus and concentrate are going to be impaired. So, you know, when you go through life, every single one of us has to constantly think about what are things that can be impacting my overall brain health, my brain inflammation, unrelated to having a disease. It's just a matter of how much function you have in those tissues. So besides just inflammation from dietary proteins, or maybe you're sensitive to food and you keep eating it, if your joints swell, your body swells, your brain's going to have inflammation. And to environmental compounds, which you can have some degree of control with, because we know things like air pollution, you know, depending on where you live, that can have an impact on brain inflammation, but that's really hard to regulate based on where you live. One of the biggest triggers for brain inflammation besides those things is really blood sugar spikes. And, you know, if you eat and you get really tired afterwards, or you eat and you crave a lot of sugar, that is really going to cause havoc on the brain. It's going to cause your pancreas to release insulin. And insulin is going to turn on these microglial cells and all these inflammatory pathways in the brain. And that's going to cause significant degeneration of the brain. And in a lot of researchers now are using the term type 3 diabetes, which is a term that's being thrown around to really focus on the intention of how much of a correlation there is between insulin and blood sugar spikes and dementia development of mechanisms associated with Alzheimer's, which is like tau phosphorylation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's one of the most overlooked and common pathways is just these blood sugar spikes. So the other key thing is if your blood sugar drops all the time, like you get shaky, lightheaded, and irritable all the time, and that's when you decide to eat. When your blood sugar levels drop and you have those symptoms, your body releases insulin to try to get any amount of blood glucose you have into your cells. So that also turns on this inflammatory cascade. So roller coaster ride of just energy levels fluctuating throughout the day. If your energy levels change all the time after you eat, like maybe you feel better, maybe you feel really tired. Those are basically major shifts that happen in our blood sugar that really promote activation of these glial cells and really can damage cause inflammation and over a period of time can really start to damage neurons. And if a person is listening to this and they're expecting to eat a meal and get tired, and that's just like normal for them, I think that's what should always happen. Or if they eat a meal and they feel energized and they're used to waiting until they can't function and focus and get hangry to eat, they're going to really promote a neurodegenerative pathway. Mm-hmm. And if that's their lifestyle and they do that for 10 years, 20 years, you know, it's really going to have a significant impact on their brain health.
Yeah. And so what you're referring to there is hyper and hypoglycemia, which both, mm-hmm. I mean, I have a lot of women that come to me to work on, you know, losing weight. And it's usually hyper people who have been consuming excess glucose for and excess carbohydrates for ever. And we sort of bring them into more of a lower carbohydrate diet. We give them lots of proteins and fats, which are much more, you know, a sustainable, clean burning sort of a source of energy. What I find with hypoglycemics, they also have that catastrophic insulin surge in the same way that the hyperglycemics are always consuming carbs and they always have that insulin marinating, you know, bathing their cells constantly. It's the same as you were saying with hypoglycemics as well. And I don't know if you find this clinically, but I find that my hypoglycemics, they tend to be vegetarian. They don't tend to eat a lot of protein. So when I asked them, I actually had she was a lawyer. She came in to my practice a couple of years ago and she was coming in for a concussion. Like she was having headaches and neck pain and stuff. And when I was asking her, you know, what happened? How did this happen? She's like, oh, well, I couldn't get to my emergency muffin in time. I was like, what are you talking about? She's like, she just doesn't eat. Like she would have maybe some, you know, like a fruit smoothie or something in the morning. And then by the end of the day, she's so spazzed because she hasn't eaten anything. And then her blood sugar drops. And then, you know, she had, you know, sort of temporarily fell and then she ended up hitting her head. I don't know if that's something, a commonality that you notice as well. I find my hypoglycemics tend not to eat a lot of protein and they tend to eat very low fat as well. So I always like to it's usually a sensitive conversation around, you know, potentially having some meat and or more good quality sources of protein that can help with satiety and be a source of energy for them through the day. Is that something that you notice or
yeah,
not?
I mean, similar. I think a lot of hypoglycemics typically aren't the ones that eat bad diets. They're not the McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, fast food people.
Right.
They usually have a healthy diet. They just will do things like have a smoothie for a meal or a gluten-free muffin and tea with honey as a meal.
Right.
So that's I think I see a similar, I guess, personality of a lot of people end up being hypoglycemics. Mm-hmm. So they also go too long without eating, or they just don't have enough substantial fat or protein to maintain their blood sugar throughout the day. Mm-hmm. And they're too high in sugar. I mean, technically, if they were vegetarian and were eating a healthy vegetarian diet with lots of vegetables, I mean, vegetables are going to have plenty of fiber and they're going to be able to maintain their protein levels if they practice vegetarian properly.
Right.
So it's more of not so much being the vegetarian, just being vegetarian doesn't make you prone to hypoglycemic. It's the fact that if you just eat sugar for a meal or eat glucose for a meal or go way too long,
right.
Or if you're vegetarian, but you can't put in enough fat in your diet, maybe olive oil, avocados and enough.
Nuts and seeds are vegetarian.
Yeah, all these things.
Yeah.
So I think there's some commonality there.
Maybe you can speak to some of the deleterious effects that prolonged sugar and prolonged insulin have on the brain. So we've been talking a little bit, you know, we started off talking a little bit about brain fog and we're trying to understand what inflammation is. And, you know, one of the things you've mentioned is that when you have elevated blood glucose or you have elevated insulin, at least you're going to be activating the microglia. Can we also see changes in the blood-brain barrier? Do we see changes? Are there areas in the brain that are particularly sensitive to excess sugars and potentially accelerating the degeneration there?
Yeah. So there's lots of different target sites for excess blood sugar and insulin. The first one is, you know, are these, they're called GLUT4 receptors. The GLUT4 receptors are what allow glucose to get into the cell. Mm-hmm. So chronic blood sugar spikes of glucose and insulin make these receptor sites inefficient. So one of the problems with that is the brain has a hard time getting glucose to its tissues and to its neurons to provide fuel for the brain. So that will start to lead to hypoglycemia actually in the brain, where the brain just can't function and can't focus in things that it needs to do, whether it's focus, concentration, or memory recall. So these episodes of poor memory, poor brain function many times, or this chronic or insulin resistance happening at this GLUT4 receptor at the brain, And we also know that insulin itself will trigger what I call tau phosphorylation. This is the mechanism where people build amyloid plaques that is associated with Alzheimer's. It just accentuates that response. Mm-hmm. We also know that when you have high degrees of insulin and glucose, you produce what are called glycated end products, meaning your glucose can't get into your tissues because you've had so much carbohydrate your whole life that you lose the efficiency of getting your insulin receptors to work to carry that glucose into your cells. This circulating glucose gets oxidized by free radicals in your bloodstream. Then you create these things called glycated end products. And then the brain, and there's an inflammatory pathway called the RAGE reaction, which stands for receptors for advanced glycated end products. That gets active in the brain and causes significant brain inflammation, which will then cause injury to surrounding neurons. The blood-brain barrier does become permeable, and the blood-brain barrier is basically blood vessels. So chronic insulin surges turn on several inflammatory mechanisms that start to cause inflammation in blood vessels. So not only is the blood-brain barrier breaking down, and the brain's getting inflamed, and the brain doesn't have proper efficiency of receptor sites, insulin receptor sites to get fuel to the brain, you start to get risk for vascular disease of the brain. So the second type of dementia, most common dementia, is vascular dementia. And chronic insulin surges promote that. So the two main types of dementia, which for number one is Alzheimer's disease, the second one being vascular dementia, are all promoted by chronic blood sugar insulin spikes. And even if you don't get to the point where you get such significant decline where you have dementia, where you can't remember friend and family's names and you get lost all the time and you can't find your way home, there's going to be a toll on the brain. Where you just may not perform. Like you may be in your industry and you may be great at what you do, but you can't do that anymore. You may love to read for hours and that's your passion, but now you can't do it anymore. So it doesn't always have to end up being dementia or disease name. Just the fact that there's chronic insulin and blood sugar spikes is going to have a devastating role in the brain. That's why it's so important to, if you're listening to this, if you eat a meal, you have to see how you feel. The only thing that should happen after you eat a meal is you're no longer hungry. If you eat a meal and you get tired, that's a red flag. You've got some insulin spikes happening. And if you eat a meal and you feel normal again and you're energized, that's a red flag, you're hypoglycemic. So the easiest way to determine if this inflammatory mechanism the brain's happening with you is to just look at how you feel after you eat. And if you have the percentage of carbohydrates and proteins and fats that your body can metabolize and process, you should have no change in energy. After you eat, you should get tired. And if your blood sugar levels are constantly dropping, you have to eat, that's a sign you're going too long without eating. You may need to have some proteins and fats. So that's a really important mechanism. I wrote a book, Why Is My Brain Working? I have a whole couple chapters on these mechanisms that really explain these things. After I wrote my brain book, I created an online program called Save Your Brain Program, where we teach people how to these concepts, and we teach the six steps how to really improve your brain function. And one of the most important steps is this blood sugar regulating mechanism.
Yeah,
and it's essential.
And I'll make sure, by the way, that that's in the show notes for people to be able to check out, because I think that's it's so important. And we just had Dr. Dale Bredesen on the podcast, and we were talking all about Alzheimer's. So just, you know, reinforcing everything that you just said, we were talking about amyloid precursor protein and the effect that insulin has on that. So if you have high insulin, so APP is going to, you know, what you want is you want it to be cleaved at the alpha site. If it's cleaved at the alpha site, then we don't have any amyloid plaques being laid down. But if you have a lot of insulin, that's going to be promoting this cleavage. I think it's at the beta and the gamma sites he was talking about. I wanted to just kind of come back to the blood-brain barrier for a moment, because you do talk about this in your book, Why Is My Brain Not Working? Is there, maybe you can explain if there are ways that if we are suspecting, so if someone's listening, they're like, okay, hot damn, yeah, I always have the tea with the honey, I always have the you know, is there a way that she can, or, you know, anyone who's listening, test, or you know, are there any biomarkers that you would suggest following? Or I know that you talk about there's like a leaky brain blood brain barrier test that you talk about in the book. Is that something that you would recommend if someone's sort of looking to see whether or not they're influencing their physiology through excess sugar consumption?
I mean, so the biomarker for blood brain barrier breakdown?
Not the biomarker for a leaky blood-brain barrier, but generally, if there are you know, pathological features, if we were to do a blood test, would you look at, you know, high sensitivity C-reactive protein? Would you look at HbA1c? What would be some of the biomarkers that you like to follow? And I'd like you to talk about the leaky brain test that you talk about.
Okay, sure. So the blood sugar markers that we use are basically the ones that are used in routine healthcare. So the first thing is, are you starting to head into pre-diabetes? So when you get a routine blood test, they usually measure fasting glucose.
Yeah.
And if your fasting glucose is creeping above 100 in the 100-115 range, you start to suspect it. If it gets above 115, then the guidelines are you definitely have insulin resistance. That once you see fasting glucose above 115, you definitely know you're going to have these mechanisms take place. And then once you get into the diabetic range, 127 or higher, that's when you have some significant increased elevation of risk with that. And then the classical marker, HbA1c or fructosamine, are used to look at these glycosylated end products that really promote breakdown of the blood-brain barrier and brain inflammation. If those are elevated, then you're really significant risk for that. Those usually end up happening with uncontrolled blood sugar levels with diabetes. Anything above 7.4 in those, the research shows, has dramatic risk. If it's above 9, there's some serious risk factors for that.
Oh man, I can't even. Like 5.1 or 5.2 for the HbA1c. I'm like, we have a problem, because that actually tracks out to about 100, a glucose level of about 100 milligrams per deciliter. So
right. Just with this risk studies done, when they find it above 9, it's really scary. What risk you're at for stroke and renal failure and so forth, but. Yeah. You know, a lot of people do. If you go and test population, a lot of people have those levels. Mm-hmm. And then for the blood-brain barrier, the standard test is what's called S100B. And all the conventional laboratories run the test. And if S100B levels are high, it suggests that the blood-brain barrier may be breaking down. Mm-hmm. There could be other reasons for S100B elevations, but that's one of the key things. Then there's labs that do actually measure things like blood-brain barrier protein antibodies, like Cyrex labs. And those are ways you can determine if that's happening.
In the book, you talk a lot about flavonoids and their role in dampening inflammation. Which ones specifically do you like? If you're suspecting someone has, they have chronic glucose and insulin, like their fasting insulin, their fasting glucose is, something that you determine to be awry. What are some of the flavonoids that you'd like to introduce into someone's protocol?
Well, I think, first you have to get the blood sugar under control. Flavonoids won't be able to compensate for that. You have enough. You're going to have to. So flavonoids, dampen the inflammatory response. They help heal tissues that are injured. And my favorite flavonoids are resveratrol, turmeric, and pomegranate extract. I think they have a lot of good research behind them. Green tea extract is also phenomenal when it comes to brain, specifically for research published on brain and anti-inflammatory effects. Mm-hmm. So I'd say the most published ones, and the ones that I like, the ones that are most published, would be green tea, turmeric, resveratrol, and pomegranate extract.
Mm-hmm. So, and maybe I jumped the gun a little bit into supplementation, but what would be some of the strategies that you'd be looking for? Maybe I should have asked you first, how would you like to lower a patient's fasting insulin? So my cutoff is about 85 milligrams per deciliter. I like to see that as my normal, or under 90. What would be some of the interventions that you might look at from either a dietary perspective or lifestyle medicine interventions?
So if you're getting tired after you eat, there's two main things you have to do to change it. You have to increase your physical activity, or whatever that is. As you increase your physical activity, that makes your GLU2-4 transporter mechanisms more efficient. It helps you clear out insulin. So that's one thing. And the second thing is you have to cut down on the degree of carbohydrates, starch, and sugar. That's the basic model. And if you just play with those two, they'll have the biggest effect. If you move more, you will have more tolerance for carbohydrates and sugar and things. If you move less, if you're sedentary, you probably have no tolerance. So, if you've maybe gone on vacation and just nothing but laying around, your insulin receptor sites become inefficient. And then if you eat something, you're really, really tired. That's a sign of it happening. And it happens quickly. It also changes quickly. So if you're noticing getting tired after meals and you just start to increase your physical activity, maybe do a 20-30 minute, stationary bike or run or walk or something, you'll notice you won't be as tired after the same meal within a few days. And that's a sign that the insulin receptors are working much more efficiently. And if you do that in combination with cutting down core sources of carbohydrates and starch and sugars, then you will be able to tell. And if you can figure out a balance between that, those two factors, and notice you're not getting tired after you eat meals, that can be beneficial. You can also use supplements to help improve the insulin receptor site while you're doing that. Berberine has a lot of new research now.
Yes, I was going to ask you about berberine.
They've actually done so many studies on berberine with clinical trials. Now it's gone to the stage where there's several meta-analyses done. Mm-hmm. And all these meta-analyses have shown a very positive effect of berberine, and lowering blood sugar. So the evidence is absolutely there, without doubt. So it has the highest level of criteria for evidence, as grade A level evidence for impacting blood sugar levels.
Yeah,
it's a very cheap and an inexpensive place for a lot of people that can't afford medication to really control their blood sugar. So there's a lot of research being done, because in some developing countries where there's high amounts of diabetes, like India, they're trying to figure out what can we do, because this population can't afford these meds.
Right.
Finding simple, cheap berberine works effectively, and in some studies even more effectively, in lowering blood sugar levels and improving the insulin receptor sites. So berberine is probably one of the most powerful ones. Things like just inositol, vanadium, B vitamins have also been published. Right. Chromium, they're the typical things you use. A lot of times when you go to a health food store or nutritional manufacturer will put all those things together in one product, just as the general like blood sugar stabilizing product. And usually you'll find vanadium, chromium, alpha lipoic acid, B vitamins in there. And then berberine is something you can take on the side. But also be careful with berberine, because it does drop blood sugar levels. So if you're hypoglycemic and you take it, you're going to crash.
Right. So the first thing is like nutrition and movement, right? I find that as humans, we love to complicate things, right? We're like, well, which one? And is it resistance training? And is it hot? Is it HIIT? Is it spin class? Is it CrossFit? Is it, you know, it's like, if you don't know, just go for a walk. You know, like I was going for me and my partner, we walk I do my own workout in the morning, and then we'll, you know, kind of midday toward, you know, after dinner, go for a walk. And it does all the things that you're talking about, right? It's like increase it, you know, you're standing up, so you're not seated at your desk. Legs are working, heart is working, you know, you're increasing your capacity for glucose disposal, because the legs are, you know, kind of gobbling up all the glucose that's being, you know, out in the bloodstream for that utilization. It's good for the, you know, cardiometabolic, like just go for a 20 minute walk. Right. And then of course you can start to add on from there with all the supplementation. And I apologize for going to the flavonoids first. Like I was so excited, because I know you talk about a lot of the botanicals, but we, you know, sometimes we have to get back to the foundational basics of nutrition and movement first, and then supplementing, as the name suggests, to supplement that with what you're, what you're talking
about. As far as exercise goes and blood sugar stability, the thing to remember also is there's research in that. The first part of the research came out years ago where they said just a brisk walk for 20 minutes can have an impact on blood sugar. Yes, and it can have a significant impact on blood sugar. That's statistically significant, but it's not clinically that relevant. So what they've actually found is, there is a degree of different types of exercise that have different impacts on blood sugar. And they have found that higher intensity exercises do have an impact on blood sugar. And one of the easiest things to do is, you know, now it's very trendy and popular, just things like a 7-minute high intensity workout, where you, for 7 minutes, you do as many push-ups as you can for 30 seconds or a minute, and then do as many air squats, and then you do as many of those types of things. So
like a little micro workout.
So what they're finding is also is like, if, you know, if going to getting into the exercise routine involves you getting totally dressed, going somewhere, putting on something in this 2-hour ritual.
Right.
And it's just waking up before you take a shower, put on an app or one of these videos that have a 7-minute workout, that can have a significant impact on blood sugar stability. Mm-hmm. And then there's some patient, and you know, you basically work to your level of what's intense for you. So you're not doing it compared to anyone else. And if some people that really have blood sugar issues, they can, sometimes they notice energy levels are low, like in the afternoon, they'll do another quick 7-minute workout.
Yeah.
And they do that for a couple of weeks. They can have dramatic changes in their blood glucose levels, so quickly.
Yeah, that's something that that's actually something that I give to my, that's something I've told my partner to do, because he sits on calls. So you and I are talking on a Zoom call right now. He talks on Zoom calls from 9 a.m. to 6. And if he's not careful, he could be sitting for that entire amount of time. So what I've had him do now is like shorten his hour calls to 45 minutes. And then, you know, he has a chance to like go to the bathroom, get a drink of water, and then he can punch out like a 10-minute workout, and he can do that 6-7 times. Yeah. Over the course of the day. And it's like, all of a sudden he's done an hour's worth of, you know, push-ups and burpees and squats and all the kind of things you were mentioning. And it's super efficient. He doesn't have to drive anywhere. Like you were saying, there's no equipment. It's just calisthenics, and it's wonderful. Yeah. Just a little quick question, because you mentioned turmeric. Do you prefer turmeric or curcumin, or is there any difference? For you?
Really, the active curcuminoids is really have the effect. So you just want to see a product with the highest amount of active curcuminoids.
Okay, because I love Indian food, so I'm just looking for an excuse to have more curries than.
I don't think I'll get enough curry bowls for what you're going to have to supplement.
I am incredibly bullish on sauna as a therapy for recovery, heart health, and overall aging well. I personally decided on an infrared sauna from Sunlighten because of the range of far wavelengths and near infrared wavelengths that it offers. Saunas help with detoxification and rejuvenation to rid your body of toxins. It helps with heart health by improving circulation, reducing blood pressure, and helping keep the arteries supple. It helps with muscle recovery by easing the tension and soreness to recover faster, and of course, stress reduction. With the warmth and the relaxation of sitting in a sauna, it's crucial for hormonal balance and achieving a state of well-being necessary for a strong physique and a strong mind. If you visit sunlighten.com/better and use code better to get a discount. That is sunlighten, sunlighten.com/better, and use code better at checkout.
All right, let's talk a little bit about circadian biology. So I want to get into a conversation around some of the detrimental effects that sleep has, or lack thereof, lack of sleep has on the brain. And I'd like to get into sort of systemic, chronic, low-grade stress as well. So let's start with sleep in terms of the effect that it has on the brain. Some of the things that I have done and, you know, learned in my own research is it, you know, causes, again, like the microglial activation, like we were talking about, inferior fuel partitioning. You tend to want more crap, like you tend to want more carbohydrates, your motivation for working out, all that thing, all that sort of tanks. But when we consider brain health in particular, what role does sleep have in inflammation in the brain and in cognitive ability and the ability to make, you know, good decisions?
I mean, for the most part, if you don't get enough sleep, your brain volume is going to change over time. It's just that simple. Mm-hmm. So sleep has impacts on every part of the brain, every mechanism of the brain. The brain, brain is made of cells. Cells need to get into recovery state and be able to activate something called autophagy to get rid of debris, bad cells. So when you lose sleep, you lose your autophagy mechanisms. You can't get rid of debris in your brain that were clustered proteins, dead neurons. That all has to be taken care of. There's changes in your brain metabolism. Your brain goes into different brain waves that are very restful in a recovery state for the brain. So just like like anything else, I mean, there has to be a state of rest. So if the brain doesn't, if you don't have enough sleep, your brain will have its impact, you know, over time.
Yeah.
So, you know, every now and then we all have issues where we don't sleep well, maybe one thing or another. But if it's a regular routine thing, like for example, someone has frequent night urination and they can't figure that out, so they're always waking up 2 or 3 or 4 times a night, that's going to have an impact on the brain. Some people, many people that are hypoglycemics, like we talked about, that crash in the afternoon, get shaky, lightheaded, irritable, and have to eat to feel better. The majority of them are going to get into what's called nocturnal hypoglycemia at night, where they wake up in the middle of the night because their blood sugar is too low.
Right.
That's going to cause sleep disturbance. That's going to impact their brain. So those are, you know, it's really important to look at those mechanisms. Most common reasons why people don't sleep well is a lot of times they have blood sugar issues, like we talked about, or they have frequent urination. It's a really big problem, especially once people get over age 40, pelvic muscles weaken. They get, men get prostate issues. Women also get what's called overactive bladder. Men and women both get overactive bladder, which is unrelated to the prostate.
Is that changes in vasopressin, or is it unrelated to that?
It's a neurogenic mechanism where they're losing integration of their small smooth muscle control. There have been studies with things like beta-sitosterol that have helped. But what happens actually is when your pelvic floor muscles weaken, when you actually activate your pelvic floor muscles, you actually activate autonomics as well that then control your bladder tone. So voluntary contraction of pelvic floor muscles, there is a feedback that then modulates the smooth muscle detrusor valve that then controls function. So you know, sometimes we just have people stop eating sodium right before bedtime because that'll also increase urination, and then we'll have them do pelvic floor muscles, male or female. Mm-hmm. That'll change the autonomic function over a period of time to build plasticity in those pathways so they can sleep. For other people, they have to control their blood sugar levels. But yeah, I mean, for a lot of people that can't sleep, they know that sleep is important for the brain and their overall health. They just don't know how to get through the night. So those are important pathways to try to consider.
One of the things when we think about what makes like a robust, healthy brain is its ability to inhibit, right? So we want like the frontal lobe to inhibit midbrain. Mm-hmm. We want the pontomedullary reticular formation to inhibit like lower, the IML or whatever. And when you don't sleep, we've all pulled all-nighters, right? Like I went to, in professional school, even in university, for sure I have my share of those, but the next day, the things that would never bother me would just throw me over the edge. You know, you spoke to me differently or something like you, because my frontal lobe is just offline. Right. So yeah. I think when we think about brain, when we think about healthy, promoting healthy brain aging, sleep, like you're saying, just has to be part of the conversation because of, one of the brain's primary roles is to inhibit sort of lower brain centers. So, I love what you're saying there. Let's talk about stress. We know that stress essentially over time makes us stupid, right? It decreases cerebral volume. There are, of course, particular areas of the brain that are exquisitely sensitive to, bathing in glucocorticoids all the time. Can you address or break down for us how stress affects our neurophysiology?
Yeah. So overall, stress is going to promote neurodegenerative pathways, but in particular, it's going to wreak its havoc on the hippocampus, which is the medial temporal lobe region of the brain, because this is the site where Alzheimer's disease develops. So cortisol elevations, chronic stress responses over a period of time, they tend to cause a greater toll on the whole brain, but more importantly, on the medial temporal lobe, the hippocampus pathways of the brain. And this is the area of your brain that's involved with your long-term memory. So your ability to recall facts, your ability to recall what you learned in school, your ability to recall your life. Yeah. Yeah. And this is the first target area of Alzheimer's disease. So you're constantly getting, Alzheimer's moments where you just can't think of something, you can't remember a person's name or can't remember something that happened. And it's getting worse and worse for you. Then this part of the brain is compromised. And that's one of the things that also have been measured with what are called circadian rhythms, which you brought up earlier. So the medial temporal lobe has a region called the hippocampus, and this is where chronic stress and cortisol impact first. And when this starts to get disrupted, you also lose the ability, in addition to having impairments of your declarative memory, is also the ability to control your circadian rhythm of cortisol release throughout the day. So that can also lead to sleep disorders and sleep problems. You kind of get a vicious cycle of that happening. And those are measured with, people do saliva tests throughout the day. They measure cortisol levels in the morning, noon, afternoon. And when that rhythm gets abnormal, then that's been shown in multiple studies now to be an early indicator for Alzheimer's disease development. And they can also look at patients that have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease and look at these cortisol circadian rhythms and predict their decline in their mental status as they see the circadian rhythms get worse. So you know, this part of the brain that is so important for us to control our rhythms so we have proper energy and sleep cycles, and also so important for us to have declarative memory, is so sensitive to stress responses and also lack of sleep. And these are the areas that tend to decay over time when we're stuck in the wrong, you know, lifestyle pattern causing these vicious cycles to happen.
Mm-hmm. And just for the listener, when we're talking about the circadian biology of cortisol, it sort of looks like a ski slope, right? So in the morning, it's at its peak. It should be at its highest amount than it is all day long. And then there's like a stepwise attenuation over the day. So it almost looks like, you know, a hollowed out L. So that's what just in case they have never done a cortisol test or not familiar about what it should look like. And usually the cortisol awakening response, we have to, when you're talking about doing those salivary tests, you have to like get the timing right, right? It's like 10 to 20 or like 30 minutes maximum after you wake up. Otherwise, we start to see cortisol levels low. So you can start to get false readings on it as well. All right, let's talk a little bit about hormones. You mentioned before waking up overnight, you know, talking about women as we age, we start to see that they're starting to wake up more. I wanted to, in our pre-chat, I was saying to you, I want to talk about low testosterone in men. I think that this is, and we haven't had a robust conversation on this yet on the podcast. And I think that this is an endemic where we're seeing most men that I've tested, the amount of testosterone is abhorrent. And, you know, of course that means that your sperm, like the sperm counts are nosediving, you know, the fertility of, and the virility of the male is going to be, decreased as well. It's like some like warped version of like the Handmaid's Tale, right? Where like, we're soon going to see this, you know, obliteration of the human race if this continues to, you know, go on. When we talk about, you know, reproduction, of course, like it's the seed and it's the soil, right? You got to have the seed from the guy and the soil for the ladies. So what is happening to the modern man and his testosterone levels?
Well, we talk about epidemiological levels. I mean, they're lowering and younger men are having so-called low testosterone syndromes than before. And, you know, the question is why, because, you know, the key thing is not like every single person should be on testosterone, every male should be on testosterone replacement therapy. More important question in a functional medicine model is like, why does that happen? Mm-hmm. And how do you change that? Because if you go on testosterone, you can also have lots of other things that happen. And one of the most common things besides low testosterone that is out there is men have normal levels of testosterone, but their estrogen levels are too high. And that has an antagonizing effect on testosterone. And what's happening with those men is they're converting the testosterone to estrogen. There's an enzyme called aromatase that gets upregulated and they cause this conversion. So for those men, if they go on testosterone, they're actually going to immediately convert to estrogen. They're going to
just get more estrogen. Yeah.
Right. So they're going to actually get less motivated. What happens with these men that are stuck in that pattern where their testosterone levels may be normal or even on the low end, but they're making high amounts of estrogen because they have this overactive aromatase pathway. And by the way, that happens from sedentary lifestyle. Insulin surges, a chronic inflammation. When they go on testosterone, they may feel a boost and have a honeymoon phase for like a couple of weeks where they feel a lot more energy and a lot more vitality. And then as that testosterone will stay in the system and build up, and this just has to be processed, it's going to really raise estrogen levels. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of those men, they go on testosterone gel, and then when you repeat their lab test, not in the first 2 weeks, but let's say 2 months later, it looks like they were taking an estrogen cream. So that's one thing to be aware of. That's why it's so important to find an underlying mechanism. But the other thing is that men do actually have low testosterone unrelated to this conversion of estrogen. And the cells that produce testosterone are called lytic cells. And these lytic cells are very, very sensitive to oxidative stress and inflammation. And then when people or men are in a chronic inflammatory state, these cells cannot regenerate to the level that they need to for testosterone demands. Mm-hmm. So just being in a chronic state of inflammation is going to impair the regeneration and the ability to synthesize testosterone at adequate levels. So the biggest cause of chronic low testosterone is actually inflammation and oxidative stress, because these lytic cells are so vulnerable to that. And if those oxidative stress inflammatory pathways are reduced, then it can improve. Like, for example, you'll see top athletes that overtrain come in with very low testosterone. And as soon as they get into a recovery phase and their inflammation goes down, the testosterone jumps back up.
Yeah.
And it happens pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to realize how important the connection is to inflammation, these testosterone symptoms, because they may not do anything for that. And then they just go on testosterone replacement therapy. And this whole mindset of like, oh, well, you're just older, you just don't make as much. No, that's not how it works. You can, I mean, that is to some degree how it works. So you can lose your feedback loop with LH.
But that just means you got to change the way you live, though. That means getting up out of your chair and doing some of those air squats for 10 minutes, you know, and yeah.
Lots of things. Yeah. There are people sometimes where they actually have so much inflammation and destruction to those cells, they may need to be on replacement.
Right.
So it depends, you know, what the clinical goals are for the person, for the patient, the bias of the practitioner they see. Some practitioners will feel every man needs to be in testosterone replacement therapy, even if their levels are normal.
Right.
Some people will go, why is that there? There'll be some patients that go, I don't want to have to take testosterone if I don't need to. Why do I have low testosterone? And then it goes back to the question of chronic inflammation, oxidative stress. So those are all the main variables, but it is common. I think it's being mismanaged altogether with the healthcare, and many people aren't looking for it either.
I agree. And I think, you know, like you were saying, of course, everything exists on a continuum, right? So there's going to be, you know, in my experience, probably 70 to 80% of low T can be improved or ameliorated with some of these lifestyle interventions that we've been talking about. I find the men that I've put on a ketogenic diet respond incredibly well, because we know that insulin, like you were saying, insulin increases that aromatase activity from testosterone to estradiol. Mm-hmm. And then in terms of the effects on the brain, in your book, you talk about testosterone being affecting the dopamine and the acetylcholine receptors. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So the impact of testosterone on the brain is different for male or female brains.
Yeah.
But for male brains, testosterone has a very powerful impact on dopamine centers. And dopamine and testosterone have synergistic activity at the receptor site for areas of the brain that are involved with motivation and drive and focus and attention. So when testosterone levels go down, one of the most common symptoms is symptoms of low dopamine. They just can't initiate, they can't follow through, they can't start anything. They have all the they have all the desire, they just can't get that thing started, or they can't finish something that they started. Mm. You know, the fence that just started got painting and never finished. It could be a low dopamine, low testosterone.
Yeah.
We see it all the time. It's actually a red flag clinically, because when we see a male come in and they have low testosterone, low dopamine, we know that they may not even follow through with their protocols.
Right.
Not because they don't want to. They don't have the physiological ability to follow through. And that's where we have to get spouse involved and let them understand that. And the low testosterone, low dopamine male is kind of stuck in a really bad spot because of this connection with the brain, because they have the desire and wanting to change things, just can't initiate. So physical activity, getting insulin down, reducing inflammation, those things all raise dopamine. They also help raise testosterone. Mm-hmm. So, but when you have someone who's kind of been in a lifestyle under a lot of stress, they kind of have become sedentary and their levels are dropping and they're inflamed and they can't activate their brain, it's really hard for them. Sometimes they do have to have a great spouse pull them into getting some care, getting some treatment, and then making sure they get through it. Mm-hmm. When I work with spouses that bring their husbands in for just chronic depression or just not the same anymore, we find this mechanism. We have to let the spouse know they're not being defiant, not being disrespectful. They just can't do it. And they're frustrated they can't do it. And you got to get them past that hump where they get some of these levels back to in order so they can function again. So those are important things. And the other thing is, when you just go into testosterone replacement therapy, you don't regenerate the degree of lytic cells as you normally would on your own. So there's a point, for example, so some people go, when I just go on testosterone, get out of that level, that may have the counter effect, because you go on testosterone, it goes into estrogen. Now you have less lytic cell potential, and now you really can't get out of that vicious cycle. So it's important to really look at the underlying mechanisms first.
Yeah. And I'm always a fan of endogenous testosterone versus exogenous, for the reasons that you said. Like, it can just look like they're on an estrogen cream. If they're just, you know, taking an oral tablet or something.
Yeah.
Let's talk about testosterone in women. Because we find the opposite in women. Like we see a lot of low T in the guys. We see high T or high testosterone. At least in my practice, I see a lot more women with excess testosterone in my opinion, it is because of this hyper consumption of glucose for many, many years. And we get this insulin resistant type of profile. What do you see for let's talk about the way that testosterone plays out in women and how that is different from how it plays out in men?
Yeah. So this is, I cover a lot of this in my brain book also. And the key thing with testosterone in females is really generated by insulin. And actually, it's not just your practice. The epidemiological studies data out there shows the number one common hormone imbalance in females or polycystic ovarian syndrome, high insulin, high testosterone. So it's the most common without doubt, in all industrialized countries, especially in the U.S. It's basically the same vicious cycle, chronic inflammation, chronic insulin surges, lack of movement, sedentary lifestyle. And then what happens with insulin surges in females is they activate these 17-20 lyase pathways in the thecal cells of the ovaries, and it causes them to produce testosterone. And then when females produce testosterone, it has a completely different effect. It's not, I mean, they can have some anger and rage issues, but that's not common. What actually happens is their metabolism gets more inefficient as they get higher testosterone. They get more insulin resistance. The conversion of testosterone to dihydrotestosterone goes up. They get hair thinning, hair loss. It's one of the most common causes of hair thinning, hair loss in women is actually from insulin. It's not from hypothyroidism.
Yeah, that's the super testosterone, the DHT. That's our super testosterone. Yeah.
And but you know, some the effect of raising DHT in some tissues is an adverse effect. It's not a beneficial effect. Mm-hmm. So I think with women, you see just the different vicious cycle. Their insulin levels go up, their testosterone levels go up, they get hair thinning, they get hair loss, their metabolism slows down, they get further insulin resistance. Mm-hmm. The insulin resistance creates chronic inflammation. Chronic inflammation causes brain inflammation. They get depression, they get mood disorders, there's a whole cascades play around. And then they walk into healthcare and then they get this polypharmacy game played with them, where they go into alternative medicine clinic and they try to think one single nutraceutical is going to fix it all, a handful of bags of supplements are going to fix it all. And it's just not that simple.
Yeah. And I often find for my ladies that have PCOS are often put on a statin, like as a prophylactic, because they have all this like altered lipid metabolism. They have, you know, elevated cardiovascular, they do have an elevated cardiovascular disease risk, but then you have, or they're put on the pill. That's the other thing. They're put on oral contraceptive to help them regulate their period, because they often often have months where they're anovulatory or the cycle is longer than 35 days. And of course both of those options, maybe it's another podcast entirely, but can have some devastating effects to her fertility. When we're talking about, you know, testosterone and its role in terms of lean muscle mass, and, you know, one of the things statins have been shown unequivocally is to decrease muscle mass, to increase muscle pain and weakness and wasting. All right, let's move into menopause and perimenopause. Lots of my ladies that listen to this podcast sort of fall in that age range. And perimenopause is this sort of diabolical time where you sort of start off with, you know, it can start off with one issue where you start off maybe more estrogen dominant because your levels of, well, I should say your estrogen levels are high relative to your progesterone levels. But then over time, it switches where your estrogen levels were once relatively high. As you have more, ovarian insufficiency, we start to see lower levels of estrogen. So walk us through how that can affect the female brain. What are some symptoms that she might be experiencing or that might clue her in to this this flux in her estrogen levels?
Okay, thing with perimenopause is there's a loss of pituitary ovarian feedback loop. So what happens is normally the normal menstrual cycle, the pituitary releases follicle stimulating hormone, which causes the release of the follicle. And then, you know, you get into mid cycle, you get NLH surge, you ovulate, you then put out progesterone. And then what happens as we get older, as women get older, their feedback loop becomes less efficient. And then what will happen is FSH levels will have these less efficient effects on the follicles. And then we get these, what happens is there's spikes of estrogens that go up and down. And it's really spikes of estrogens going up and down that cause things like hot flushes and sweating, insomnia. And, you know, for most, for females, when we talk about perimenopause, some transition very efficiently through it and some do not. Mm-hmm. Some will just go, hey, my cycles started getting longer and longer, and then I just didn't have him. And it was really no big deal. I don't know why people complain about it. And then other women are like, I'm going to kill everyone in my family. I need help.
So true.
This is too much. Yeah. So they can't adapt. And they're the ones that have these fluctuating estradiol levels all over the place. And they're really in a bad place. And part of that is they don't have the compensatory mechanisms to take to deal with it. So normally, you know, our adrenal glands also produce this estrogen. So if their adrenal glands are not as efficient physiologically, then they can't stop those, to balance out for those fluctuations. So those fluctuations between FSH and estrogen are going to happen because of normal aging. If the adrenal glands are working, then they can balance out these humps. So if the levels drop, they can quickly bring it up. So as soon as the levels spike, the adrenal glands kick in and bring it back up. So there's never really big dips. People that don't have that compensatory mechanism, they have huge dips. And these huge dips are causing these vasomotor responses that are causing hot flushing and sweating, and also estrogen levels spiking up and down impact brain chemistry. So they can all types of mood disorders and depression and all the things that go with it. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to really have healthy adrenal function before you transition into perimenopause, which goes back to, I guess, the theme of everything we talked about is blood sugar stability, and make sure you're not hypoglycemic, make sure you're not insulin resistant. Those things can make a big difference to have the health of the adrenal glands so you can physiologically adapt if you're going into perimenopause. Now, if you're already in perimenopause and dealing with all this stuff, then you're just basically in crisis care and trying to control symptoms. When people go on estrogen replacement therapy, their estrogen levels are just now stable all the time, and maybe even high, but they're stable all the time, so they don't have any more symptoms. And they sometimes they confuse it as, oh, I must have been estrogen deficient because now I'm taking estrogen and now those symptoms are gone. So it was a deficiency issue, but it's not really a deficiency issue. It's a spiking, fluctuating issue.
Mm-hmm. And if so it'd be like the lack of the adrenals to compensate for.
Yeah. So if your estrogens are always, if you're taking it every day and you always have an X amount, there's no more spikes.
Right.
But then this is where, you know, some of the concerns come in for some susceptible, not all, but some susceptible women that have estrogen receptor sensitivity for certain tumors or have different clotting genetic uniquenesses where estrogen really promotes clotting. Because mm-hmm. we know that there is, for some group of women, there's some increased risk for strokes and heart attacks and embolisms and even some estrogen sensitive cancers. So, you know, sometimes women are like, well, what do I do? And then the thing is like, if you have a person that's having the estrogen fluctuation levels and they have significant hot flashes because they're able to compensate and they go on estrogen replacement, they think now that they were estrogen deficient and they need to be on it forever. And then they stay on it. And then maybe they go, I don't want to be on this anymore. I have risk factors in my family. I really, you know, don't like the way my fibrinogen levels are looking, whatever the case may be. And then when they go off, all of a sudden their levels now totally drop. And also, when you're on estrogens for a long period of time, the estrogen receptor sites lose some sensitivity, so they become resistant also. Now when they go off, it may take 2 to 4 weeks for these estrogen receptor sites to regenerate to deal with not having those hormone levels. They're going to get all their perimenopause symptoms coming back. And so now they're confused. And now they're going, oh my God, I have to take estrogens. I'm just deficient. But when you look at their labs, they're off the chart with estrogens and they may have some risk factors. Mm-hmm. So for them, sometimes just getting through that phase where their levels get cleared out of their body and the receptor sites respond, something they have to go through if they're wanting to transition out. But then there's also research that shows, you know, estrogens are really important for brain health, and women that are on estrogen replacement therapy have greater neuroprotection and have greater bone density. So, you know, there isn't a simple answer. There's all these different factors involved. Ultimately, at the end of the day, you have to look at the patient's risk factors, their symptoms, their personal belief system of how they want to manage their own health, and to try to figure the right option for them. But perimenopause, you know, those are the main issues.
And what, how would you introduce adrenal support there? So if you're, you know, if you have the inability of the adrenals to have this compensatory output of estrogen because of chronic stress or chronic inflammation, what are some of the strategies that you like to employ? And of course, I know it's individual for each patient, yeah. But what are some general rules, some general guideposts that you like to employ when we're thinking about adrenals? Yeah. And maybe it's not just the adrenals, maybe it's like the HPA axis and like the sympathetic tone of the person. Like maybe you can, what are some things you like there?
Well, if they're already in the perimenopause stage, it's almost too late to get any real effect from that. Other than you still have to stabilize your blood sugar levels. You still have to reduce the stress, to get sleep. Those are the main lifestyle things. So basically you have lifestyle factors, you have dietary factors, and then you have nutraceuticals you can use. So lifestyle factors, they got to get proper sleep. They have to reduce their stress levels to the point that it's not taxing their soul, their spirit, their mind. Mm. And then and they have to get some degree of physical activity or exercise to reduce their stress, not necessarily overtrain. Those are things that help support the adrenal glands.
And recover, lifestyle factor. And recover. No one recovers. No one, like you were saying, the professional athletes, like we will go to, you know, a CrossFit 5 days a week, especially like the type of women that I tend to attract, the same woman that I am, which is like type A, overachiever, nerds out on everything, no rest. And then when you don't recover, when you don't give yourself, because that's where all the gains are, right? You work out for, you know, 4 days a week, but if you don't give yourself that fifth day or that sixth day to like just actually reap those gains, like nothing, you're always inflamed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then besides lifestyle, their diet has to just be, you know, really high and healthy. I mean, it's basically a healthy diet and nutraceuticals. There's lots of different botanicals out there, things called adaptogens, rhodiola, ashwagandha, things people can sometimes do to support their adrenal glands.
What does a healthy diet mean to you? What does that mean to you?
Real food, not processed food. Mm-hmm. So healthy diet today, just basically that's what it means. Like real vegetables, real food has been processed. There's not a bunch of chemicals added to it. Doesn't come from a bag or box. That's
shop the perimeter of the aisles, basically. Don't go up and down the aisle in the grocery store.
Yeah. I mean, before you get into like, should you be vegetarian? Should you do keto? Should you do all that? You just have real food.
Mm. Like, yeah. Any, in terms of nutraceuticals, would you ever, that can help augment brain function in women or men, would you want to target like the, you know, acetylcholine, like we were saying, maybe GABA for someone who is very anxious, or serotonin to help with some of the mood disorders and cognitive thinking?
Yes and no. I mean, you can do them. In my brain book, Why Is My Brain Working? I have a chapter for each one of those neurotransmitters, acetylcholine, dopamine, GABA, and serotonin. And I just review the literature of all the things that have ever been shown to raise those levels. Lots of natural compounds have been shown to raise those levels. It's kind of not the, it depends on what your clinical goals are. If your goals are to improve your memory, focus, and concentration, you can do things to raise your acetylcholine. If you have a tendency to anxiety and nervousness, there's some natural compounds that can help activate GABA receptors to kind of take the edge off, you know. And then same thing with dopamine and serotonin. But ultimately, in the way we teach people these concepts in my Save Your Brain online course and in the Why Is My Brain Working, is that's not the most efficient place to start. Most efficient place to start is get proper fuel to the brain, get proper oxygen, meaning proper circulation and blood flow to your brain. Make sure you get your blood sugar levels under control. Make sure those things are all in order before you start going into the neurotransmitter route. Because if you go into the neurotransmitter route first with different nutraceuticals, botanicals, you really don't get much of a clinical effect.
So let's talk about how we can build a healthy brain. We've been sort of talking about all the different, you know, catastrophic events that can happen from neuroinflammation, from brain fog, from chronic stress, sleep deprivation, blood glucose levels out of whack. In your book, you talk about ways that we can build a healthy brain. And one of my dear friends, Jim Quick, is a brain coach. And he talks about the way that you build out neurons is through nutrition and novelty. And you talk about this very similarly. You talk about having
novelty.
novelty meaning like stimulation or things that are new to the brain. And you talk about that as well. You talk about stimulation, you talk about oxygenation to the brain, you talk about glucose levels, which we've been talking about a lot. I want to touch on oxygenation because just because you're breathing doesn't mean that your brain is getting oxygen. And I would notice this. It was such an alarming trend. I would typically, I used to have a brick and mortar practice. Now my practice is mainly online, but we would take new patients somewhere around 10 o'clock in the morning. So we'd have sort of this rush of, you know, patients coming in for their care between like 7 and 9, and then, you know, 9, 10, 11 o'clock, new patients, we'd take them. And we would just pop on an oximeter for them while we were doing HRV or some other test. And these are like 30 or 40 year olds. That was sort of the demographic of the patient base that I had, maybe 50. And they would have at 10 in the morning, O2 levels, O2 saturation levels of like 94%, which is low for 10 in the morning. So let's talk about, first of all, why that's problematic. But first I want to talk about why, you know, what the role of oxygen, what that is in the brain, and what are some of the confounding variables that can influence the ability for oxygen to permeate and get into the brain.
Sure. I mean, pulse ox 94, you got to rule out pulmonary issues, cardiovascular issues, and asthma and all those things. That's not anywhere close to healthy or normal.
Yeah.
It's definitely a red flag. Mm-hmm. But when you look at a pulse ox levels, I mean, pulse ox is just one way of looking at a calculation of different lights going through red blood cells that are oxygen unconjugated, and you get a number. It's not necessarily, you know, it's one way to look at this, but also just temperature, just cold hands and cold feet. It's a good way of looking at circulation, which may not always reflect the pulse ox, because you could have someone has a pulse oximeter reading of 98, 99%, but their hands and feet are freezing and cold. Right. So the most common things with getting oxygen to the brain, blood is really, first of all, blood pressure. People that have very low blood pressure have what's called low perfusion. And perfusion is the ability to push oxygen into your tissues. So, you know, a lot of people have really poor brain endurance and brain function because their blood pressures are just too low. So mm-hmm. Let's say systolically below 100 or diastolically, you know, below 70, like 90 over 60 or something like that. That's really going to impact perfusion, cause poor circulation in hand, feet, cold hands, yep. Poor nail beds, wet nail beds. And it's also mean less oxygen to the brain. So for some people that come in my practice and we're really looking at how to improve their brain function, we may just start with looking at strategies to improve their blood pressure and why their blood pressure is so low. Mm-hmm. So that's another line of oxygenation. Anemia always has to be ruled out. We have to make sure that you have to do a CBC to make sure there's no underlying anemia. Of course, there's lots of different causes for anemia. Mm-hmm. But things like anemia and poor circulation, poor blood pressure are really important mechanisms that decrease oxygen delivery to the brain, but also decrease blood perfusion into the brain, especially when you look at blood pressure and circulation. And blood is really where it carries all these nutrients. So if you have someone who's got really poor perfusion, really cold hands and feet, really low blood pressure, even if they're taking lots of nutraceuticals and their blood is filled with all these different vitamins and minerals and things to support the brain and flavonoids, if it can't get into the brain, can't get pushed into cells, there's no effect.
Right.
So when it comes to the field of oxygenation, perfusion, oxygenate, those things are all really, really important. And then some people have things like asthma, and they have pulse oxes that are really low, and it's environmental, and you have to remove, they find out, you do some testing and you find out they're sensitive to the different trees in their neighborhood, and they can't breathe well. And they're always they're getting bronchoconstriction. So they do have that low pulse ox. So in order to change your brain function, you have to deal with the histamine response and their exposures. And, you know, so that's the key thing with looking at a physiological aspect of brain and as it relates to oxygen.
Are there ways that you like to improve oxygenation?
Well, so if there's an underlying mechanism, like it is bronchoconstriction, like asthma, that would be one approach. If it was low blood pressure, that could be a different approach. They just have like, you know, there's no real cause and their circulation's just always been bad. Physical, high intensity exercises can raise endothelial and endothelial nitric oxide levels, which can help with circulation blood flow. There are nutraceuticals that can help aid with blood flow and circulation. Beetroot extract has been shown to raise levels. And postatin is very good to raise endothelial nitric oxide levels to help with circulation and blood flow. So that's a combination of things. And, you know, everyone's unique. There's some people you struggle forever to try to figure out how to get their asthma to control. And it's not like a quick thing. You have to work through different factors. For the other people that have low blood pressure, you can try all these different strategies to get the blood pressure back up, but they don't respond as well. So right. As you know, the real practice is different, you know? And I think this is the frustration. Like, this is how it really works. So people that are trying to find like the one protocol thing to do to change the brain, like, good luck. And then at the same time,
and also let me know once you find it.
And then also and then some patients don't have the motivation and drive to kind of address all those issues. So that's another factor. Mm. There's also the issue of practitioners. A lot of practitioners, how do you say it, just suck. They're the same mind. They want to just give someone a simple protocol or blame everything in the brain, red heavy metals, or they don't go through the detailed steps. And at the end of the day, it's a combination of all those factors that really impact a clinical outcome.
Right. Yeah, that's a really good point. I often find, I want to be very careful, but I, you know, in terms of respecting all my colleagues, but sometimes you'll find like someone who is just all in for Lyme, like everything is Lyme. It's because they've had either a personal experience, like someone in their family, and then they figured out something that really worked well for them. And then that becomes the underlying thing for everyone, right? Or like you were saying, like there's some cookie cutter thing that, that you've developed, and then you just sort of give it out to everyone, irrespective of genetics, irrespective of the patient's goals, irrespective of, what's actually going on. It's just, they sort of want to, you know, churn them in and churn them out. That's very true as well. All right. I wanted to, maybe talk about one of my favorite supplements. I know that you have a lot of thoughts on fatty acids. So when we think about therapeutic interventions for the brain, and when we think about this in the context of inflammation, bringing omega-3s into the mix is often a good idea, particularly when we're trying to balance out the amount of omega-6s that we take in versus the amount of omega-3s. And of course, the omega-3s, of course, have, you know, we have EPAs and DHAs. So can we talk a little bit about fatty acids, what your views are on them, and then when is it appropriate to give somebody a supplement or a fatty acid concentration that has higher EPA, and when is it appropriate for them to have higher DHA?
Sure. Yeah, I talk a lot about this in my book. And the key thing is, so fish oils we know are really critical and really important. Fish oils have an EPA component or a DHA component, and they both have similar effects in reducing inflammation. EPA seems to have a better anti-inflammatory effect, and DHA seems to have a better effect on making cell membranes in the brain more flexible and more fluid, and an impact on neurosynaptic pathways. So, for some people where they don't have a lot of inflammation, you're just trying to improve their brain fluidity and flexibility, taking something with higher DHA could be a good strategy. So, for example, kids that are on a healthy anti-inflammatory diet, but you really want to improve their fatty acid content for the brain, using a high DHA supplement may be a better strategy. And then you may have someone who just has chronic brain inflammation and body inflammation, and just taking a regular fish oil that has EPA or high amounts of EPA could be useful. The problem with DHA is that it's expensive. So when you look at supplements that are higher in DHAs, they're not cheap.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, just using a basic fish oil that has both is fine too. It just depends on the situation. And most people could probably get away with just a regular fish oil that has both EPA and DHA. If you're really dealing, like in my practice, if you're really dealing with a person who's had severe brain injury, or dealing with a child with a developmental disorder, or really trying to go after the brain very aggressively, we'll use a higher DHA and just deal with the cost. because we're really just trying to get those fatty acids to the brain. But trying to use DHA in high amounts when there's lots of inflammation can be not as a clinically efficient and effective, because you really have to get that inflammation down and use that DHA for the for the fat solubility mechanisms of the brain.
And thoughts on ALA, alpha-linoleic acid?
Yeah, alpha-linoleic acid. I mean, you can do all the different variations of different fatty acids, a diverse source of fatty acids, whether it's blackcurrant or flaxseed or fish oils or EPA, DHA, they're important. For some people, just mix them all up. I mean, there's some patients out there that are fat phobic. They just don't eat any fat. And they just really, they get all types of metabolic imbalances. The prostaglandin levels get thrown off. Fatty acids get converted to what are called prostaglandins. Prostaglandins, by the way, are the main mechanism to control pelvic cramping. So a big clue that a person, female, may have prostaglandin essential fatty acid imbalances, that they have chronic menstrual cramping. That whole pathway is prostaglandin based. So for them, sometimes fish oils don't do anything. They have to actually go into evening primrose oil or blackcurrant seed oil to make a big difference, with flaxseed oil or combination of olive oil and all these other things. We just know that, fried foods are not the way to go. We need the healthier oils.
Right.
So combination of different oils would be ideal. Like for my own family, my own daughter, we try to get olive oil, avocado oil, flaxseed oil, blackcurrant oil, give a diversity of different healthy fatty acids for just general prostaglandin function and fatty acids.
And when we think about the brain, of course, the way that I like to describe it is, it's just like a big blob of fat with like wires in it, right? So of course we need, I mean, that's very overly simplistic, but when you're talking to a patient, when I'm trying to speak to them about the value of fats, because we have, there still persists this fear around fats and this fear around cholesterol levels, and that these things are going to trigger, you know, you're going to get atherogenic plaqueing and MIs and of course that's true in a certain, there are certain people with genetic predispositions where they do have very poor lipid metabolism, particularly in the saturated fat realm. But it is so important for, like, I attribute my skin, my hair, and my nails to olive oil, Brazil nuts, and the salmon that I eat. And it's because I have a lot of fat in my diet. And of course, that's just an N of one, right? So that's just me. But I do find that the more I can inch up a woman's consumption of fat, the better she typically feels. When you're talking about, you know, menstrual pain, particularly like middle smirch, when they sort of have that feeling of pain around ovulation, and then in the luteal phase leading up to their period, that sort of inflammatory, like where IBS and, you know, sort of migraines and depression and moodiness tend to get aggravated, more fat usually in that time, I have found, with the women that I work with, to help a lot. So, well, I just want to tell you, it's been a delight speaking to you. I said this to you in the pre-chat, you have more letters after your name than I think I have in my entire name in total. You're so well-researched, so well-known in the healthcare world. So I want to thank you for your time and you know, the cognitive flexibility even that you've shown in our discussion and your approach to care has been lovely to experience. So I wanted to thank you. I'll make sure that all of the links that we've been talking about in terms of your program and your book are in the show notes for our listeners as well.
Okay, fantastic. Thank you for having me.
All right. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And I must give you the obligatory legal and medical disclaimer here. This podcast, Better with Dr. Stephanie, is for general information only. And the advice, recommendations we discuss do not replace medicine, chiropractic, or any other primary healthcare provider's advice, treatment, or care. In the consumption of this podcast, there is no doctor-patient relationship that has been formed, and the use and implementation of the information discussed are at the sole discretion of the listener. The information and opinions shared on this podcast are not intended to be a substitute for primary care, diagnosis, or treatment. In other words, guys, be smart about this. Take it with a grain of salt. Take this information to your primary healthcare provider and have a discussion with him or her to make the best choice that is for you. Remember, I am a doctor, but I am not your doctor. And these conversations are meant for educational purposes only.